and Hagman, coming to you live. Our very special guest, Patrick Wood, technocracy.news. That's his website, technocracy.news. Grab a hold of his book, Technocracy Rising. The information contained between the covers is just absolutely phenomenal. You know, you just look at the book, the back cover, of course, the dark horse of the New World Order is not communism, socialism, or fascism. It's technocracy. I know we're regressing here a little bit, but for those joining us, I want to say hello to the people joining us right now from the great state of Alaska. God bless you. Thanks for checking in with us, as well as the people in Canada. God bless you. New South Wales, Australia, listening live. Thank you for tuning in. Started in the 1930s and reintroduced by the Trilateral Commission in 1973 as a new international economic order, as Mr. Wood states on the back cover. It is now known by names like sustainable development and the green economy. And as Mr. Wood stated, it's technocracy is a movement that began in the 1930s by engineers, scientists, and technicians that proposed the replacement of capitalism with an energy-based economy. That's what we're talking about. That's what the introduction that Mr. Wood gave. And of course, the authors, Huxley, Orwell, believed that technocracy would result in the scientific dictatorship, and isn't that what we're seeing right now? Indeed. Developed right before our very eyes, and boy, I hope before the end of the program, Mr. Wood will give us some ideas on how to throw a monkey wrench, and a big one at that, into this plan. Yeah. Before we get to him, I just want to mention again, the importance of this cannot be understated. The war by Hillary, Diane Rodham, the witch, the Yak Clinton, is on. It's going to be exacerbated when we have Dick Morris on next week, political consultant for the Clintons.
Former.
That's right. And he's going to be giving us
the book,
Armageddon.
Armageddon.
That's right.
Subtitle has something to do with the Clintons.
Yeah, and I want to thank John Robertson publicly for all of his hard work. But let's get back to Mr. Wood. Mr. Wood, go ahead and continue. Pick up where you left off. We give you the mantle. We give you the floor. Go ahead.
Thank you. My floor is, we won't comment on the condition of the floor, okay?
Well, you know it's bad. Well, I was going to say, you know it's bad when, but I'll just leave that go. Yeah.
For sure. Well, the idea of scientific control over an economic process, that is, all of the economic process in the world, it depends on total information awareness within that economic system. And that's why I was saying that they had to have control over the intelligence network in our country so that they could collect that kind of data that would allow them to do what they intend to do. And this is it. Now, when I first suggested this a couple of years ago, actually I started talking about it before my book, but people, come on. Yeah, that's a little bit far-fetched, isn't it? It's a little radical to think that somebody could actually hijack the entire intelligence network in America for some other peculiar purpose other than the American, you know, protecting America. I said, well, exactly. Here's the evidence that came out since then that just drives this nail home. A few months ago, Obama came out and said that they called it a secret race database. It wasn't secret at all, but it was a view of the national data set, if you will, that contained information about race and where people lived all over the country, about the cities that they lived in, and you know, how many minorities lived there, and you know, what did they do? What was their education? What was their living standard? Their income, et cetera. They call this a racial database. All it really was just a subset of the data that had to do with race. And Obama said he's going to use that racial database to rebalance all of the communities in America with racial balancing. That's what he called it. He's going to use this database for that purpose. Now, here's one example of how the information that's being collected by the intelligence community is being used against us and will continue to be used against us. Another perfect example was in Oregon, where Oregon announced, I want to say earlier this year, that they're going to put a little black box into automobiles there, and it's going to be a GPS tracking device. It's going to track everywhere your car goes. And there'll be monitoring poles, listening stations, if you will, set up where when you drive by one, your data will be harvested. And the state will send you a special use tax bill. It used to be like gasoline taxes paid for the roads, but they're thinking this is new. This is scientific, you know. So they're going to measure every mile that you drive, whether it was on a freeway, a back street, or whatever, you know, county road, county highway, city highway. And they're going to send you a specialized bill just for you. They're going to calculate it based on your habits and stuff. Well, I was naturally suspicious about such a thing. Who dreams up stuff like this anyhow? So I did some research and looked around, and lo and behold, I came to the University of Iowa, and I found out that this is where one of the seedbeds was of this thinking. They were talking about that, this very thing. And I found a slide presentation by one of the professors that had cooked this concept up. And in his slide presentation, he said very bluntly that their intent in the end, their ideal intent, is to use data to calculate your carbon footprint so that they can engineer an invoice just for you based on your carbon footprint, like how much grass do you have, how much water do you put on it, what kind of car do you have, do you ride public transit, do you take a bus, do you ride your bicycle to work, you know, what's your lifestyle, how big is your home, do you take vacations, etc. Calculating your carbon footprint to create a specialized bill for you as you drive your car on the highway. Now, the question comes up, where is that carbon footprint data housed? Where is it? Well, guess where? It's in the intelligence community has a nice, nifty little database with just about every conceivable piece of information that you can imagine, where all it's waiting for is somebody to ask the right question. Like, what's Joe Hagman's carbon footprint look like? Has he been good little boy, or does he need to be spanked because he's consuming too much of the world's
resources?
You do breathe, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm behind the eight ball there.
And this
is where we're headed.
This is using the national database for purposes that have nothing to do with the national database. It's just they're going to use it to punish people for not having a low enough carbon footprint. So, you know, you could conceivably one day be going online to Expedia to buy a plane ticket. Maybe you had to visit a sick, you know, relative or something in California, and he said, "Man, I got to have an emergency ticket." You get online and you buy the ticket, you are not buy it, but you get it all lined up and whatever, and go to buy it, and a little message comes up on the screen. "Sorry, Mr. Hagman, but you've exceeded your carbon footprint for the last 3 months. So we can't sell you a ticket, a plane ticket to California at this time. However, if you'd like to try again next month and you do these certain things, I'll give you a list, I suppose. Better luck next time. You know, clean your act up a little bit. toe the line. Think about the common good. You know, think about everybody else instead of just yourself." Yeah. You know, that hasn't happened yet. But this is where it's headed. It's just as clear as crystal. When you, the more you understand this kind of garbage, the more you can see what these people are doing. It just blows your mind. And even when I tell people stuff like this, they still go, "Oh, wait a minute, I can't believe that." Here's the killer example I give them. Go down to your bank on Saturday or after hours and try and draw out all the money in your savings account. Hopefully you got one. But let's say you have $5,000 in your bank. And you go down to the ugly teller, that's the mechanical teller, and you put your card in and you punch up $5,000. And it says immediately, "I'm sorry, but your daily limit is $300. So, "Oh, crud. Okay. Give me $300. And you're thinking, "I'll get smart. I'll just go down to the branch down the street and get another $300. I can do that all day until I get all $5,000. You go down to the other branch, put in your card, say, "Give me $300. They say, "Sorry, Mr. Hagman. You exceeded your daily allowance." You go, "Oh, shoot. I knew I was back at the other bank, didn't it? Darn, I can't get my money out." So then you get a bright idea. You think, "I'll go over to the competitor's bank across the street where my card will work, and I'll get $300 out of their bank." And you go over there and you do the same thing. It's the same message. "Sorry, Mr. Hagman, you've exceeded your daily allotment of $300. And at that point, you can pound on that machine all you want. You can scream, holler, cuss, stamp your feet, hold your breath until you turn blue. The only thing you're possibly going to do is get the cops down on your, you know, butt, because they're filming everything that you do in front of the ugly teller, and you're not going to get your $5,000 for love nor money on a weekend. Period. End of subject. And you can go into the, you can yell at the bank manager on Monday all you want. He's just going to say, "Look, that's a policy that was set above me. I don't have anything to do with it. I can't change it, and I wouldn't even know who to call. Don't have any idea. That's just the policy of our bank." And you'll realize sooner or later you've been had. That there just isn't any way. See, this is being constricted by the system. Somebody up there said, "Don't give him more than $300 a day. Period. No subject. That's it." Could they give him $5,000 if they wanted? Sure, they could. They don't want to do that. So that's the policy. They set a policy in place, and all you have to do is follow the policy. And if you follow it, you won't run into trouble with anybody. You don't follow it, there's going to be trouble. This is the nature of technocracy and scientific dictatorship. This is the nature of controlling both production and consumption down to the, you know, to literally to the gnat's whisker. And, you know, we're starting to feel it, but people still don't recognize it yet. There's a lot of angst in America right now. People don't see it. What they feel the pain, they just don't know what's causing the pain. Listen to what Christiana Figueres said last year. She was the head of climate change at the United Nations, and she's in a European press conference, and this is what she said. I watched her lips. I watched it. I've transcribed it. She actually said it. She said, "This is the first time in the history of mankind," speaking for the UN, "that we are setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution," close quote. Who can't understand that language? This woman has declared war on the entire economic system of our planet. Capitalism and free enterprise. It's inconceivable. She said this. They have a plan. They have intention. They have a time schedule, a defined period of time, she says. I'd like to see that calendar, wouldn't you? I'd like to know it. Can you show me the details, lady?
Mr. Wood, talking about the transformation of the economy through, you know, this technocracy and system of control, what are we looking at here in terms of the digital currency, a digital economy? We see a move in other countries, Denmark being, you know, one of the top countries, that we see cashless societies becoming the norm. Here in the U.S., you see, you know, in Louisiana, it's illegal to buy secondhand goods with cash. And we're seeing this war on cash. As we know, that our U.S. dollar has lost 98.99% of its value since the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. What will this technocracy, this system of control, do to our cash society?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you brought that up. I probably would have forgotten it. But you remember back to my definition on what is technocracy, where it talked about the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism? And it talks about producing and distributing goods to the entire population, right? Entire, the word entire. No child left behind. No spender left behind. Now, when you hear somebody like Larry Summers, who is one of our... well, I say it loosely, one of our top economists. He's a well-known economist. That's better. Also, a member of the Trilateral Commission, I might add. When you see somebody like Larry Summers producing at least a paper a month or a statement a month on why we need to go cashless, you have to ask the question, okay, something else is afoot here. You know, it's not just... Oh, it's not just about laundering money for peace sake. Who would believe that? It's not just about catching drug dealers. Who cares? They're always going to find a way to deal drugs. But the cashless society, the purpose that they're pulling cash out is to drive everybody into the system. They can't afford to have 20% of the world outside of the financial system. They have to force them in. Now, what better way to do that than just pull the money out and say, look, you're all going to get a card. You're all going to get, you know, maybe your card's going to have your food stamp allotment on it. Maybe it's going to have, your welfare check on it or whatever. But everybody's going to get a card, whether you want one or not. Whether you're in Africa, whether you're in South America, whether you're poor, whether, you know, living out in the middle of the Serengeti, everybody's going to get a card and be inducted into the digital system. People are still worried about currencies today. Well, the dollar is going to, you know, tank, and the yuan is going to, you know, take over the world. Oh, maybe it's going to be SDRs with IMF, and, you know, people get all worked up over currencies and which one is going to be supreme. They don't get it at all. If they understood technocracy, they wouldn't even be opening their mouth, because what's coming, there's only one currency that can support technocracy. Only one. And that's an energy currency. That's the lifeblood of an economic system, right? It's like you got blood in your body. I hope you do. No, I know you do. I do too. If we didn't have blood in our body, we would not be alive. The life is in the blood. That's what the Bible says. And the life of an economic system is in the currency. It's the blood that makes everything flow and work in an economic system. Technocracy requires, by definition, an energy currency, period, end of subject. We see the building blocks of this with all the stinking cap and trade programs around the world and the taxation programs that are being designed to tax people on carbon, which is always related to energy, by the way. And two years ago, we actually saw an energy conference take place, a currency conference take place in Croatia, of all places, where economists came from all over the world to talk about an energy-based currency. Lo and behold.
With this energy-based currency, could we see it to the point where a person has to contribute labor or some form of contribution on a daily basis in order to be able to eat, or is this something different that you're talking about?
No, I think that when all of your data is available at their disposal, they will be able to decide how to allocate energy credits to you. And you can say this for sure. If you have a very poor carbon footprint, where they think that you're consuming more goods and services than what everybody else is and than what you deserve, they'll punish you. There'll be something that will work against you to try and force you into the correct behavior. Whether that be cutting your energy allocation, whether that be limiting your purchase of certain items, I can't say. I mean, that's just, that would just be speculating. But this is the concept that they write and talk about. So people that play along with their little game will have all of the dancing in the daisies that they can stand. If you don't go along with their little program and do what they say, you'll be walking on a bed of hot coals. And they'll say, take your pick. We don't care. You want to walk on hot coals? Go right ahead. But, you know, they'll try and force you into their behavior. we see this kind of behavior modification, by the way, going on constantly in society in various ways, whether it be through marketing and propaganda type stuff, or whether it be, you know, things like your, you know, like you can't get money out of the bank on the weekends. So if you want money, you better do it beforehand, like during the week, better plan ahead. But, you know, their intent is to force you into behavior that they have specified as the correct behavior. This is the problem. This is the rub. It just is, it just stinks. You know, I had a friend who lived in Switzerland for a time, moved from Germany to Switzerland. They had to rent a flat. And they were there for a while, and one afternoon, the wife of my friend had a load of laundry in. And all of a sudden, and full of water, just go like that, and all of a sudden the washer stopped, and she like freaked, you know, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? You know, like there's water in the tub, I can't even get them out. How am I going to get them dry? And so she called the apartment manager, and you know, eventually somebody came up, and she explained the dilemma. My machine is broken, and you know what could have happened to it. He laughed and said, oh, no, your machine was turned off by the power company. They do that sometimes because, you know, they put policies in. They want you to wash your clothes after midnight. And if you exceed too much of a this or that or whatever, you know, they'll just shut it off. So he said, don't worry about it. Just wait till midnight, turn your machine on, and you'll be fine. And he left. And she was sitting there looking at her washing machine full of water, understanding a little bit more about technocracy than she probably ever wanted to know. But hey, you know, that's if they can, they will. And this is what they're doing. This kind of stuff is just happening all over the world. It's just absolutely incredible. And to think, to imagine how these people can arrive at this kind of mentality where they think it's okay to tell everybody else what to do. It's just incredible.
Fits right into Bible prophecy. So, I mean,
well, it does. I mean, you can see how the system could be, could be a set of policies could be put in place, software policies, in such a system as we have today. That if you exceed the boundaries of what they think is the right kind of life, you simply are going to have a switch thrown on you, and you won't be in the system anymore. You'll be blocked, if you will, from buying and selling, especially if there's an energy currency that does all, you know, that allows for the buying and selling.
Mr. Wood, if I could just get your opinion here before the break. Is this a system? I mean, obviously, we've seen this incrementally be implemented as time continues to roll on. And it's becoming more overt. Do you believe that this can be implemented without some kind of major event, or would we need some kind of, you know, cyber event that, you know, knocks all the computers down and banking and whatnot for a short period of time? Then they reboot and say, this is what we have to do. Or couldn't this just be rolled in, you know, right on top of the current system?
As in the 1930s, capitalism has to be perceived as dead. That has not happened yet. I think we're probably well on our way to that at this point, looking at the global economic system. But Capitalism needs to die and roll over before technocracy can really take hold. They're laying the infrastructure of technocracy today as we speak. But the greater part of capitalism and free enterprise is going to have to take a nosedive before the phoenix of technocracy can rise up out of the ashes, if you will. Maybe that's a little draconian to say it that way, but you know, that's the way it looked back in the Great Depression. They really thought it was dead, and that the end of the world had come for tech, for capitalism and free enterprise. So we see this. We see things today that kind of indicate somebody's trying to push Humpty Dumpty off the wall. If Humpty Dumpty is capitalism and free enterprise and our economic system, he might fall anyway on his own power, but it seems like somebody is trying to give him a good old shove off the wall. There's a huge moral hazard, isn't there, amongst the global elite right now, wanting to speed the process up, and let's just get it over. Would you? Let's just go do it. And let's hurry up with it, man. We're ready for something new.
That's the attitude. Mr. Wood, we're up against our break. We'll be right back after these short messages. Folks, you're listening to Patrick Wood, author of Technocracy Rising. Technocracy Rising, must-have book. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Talking with author Patrick Wood about his book Technocracy Rising, The Dark Horse of the New World Order. Folks, if you missed the first half of the program, I urge you to go back and listen to it, as well as the rest of the program. We have only scratched the surface on a number of issues pertaining to technocracy, what it means, the history behind it, how it relates to the New World Order, and works like George Orwell's 1984 and other authors that talked about a brave new world, a new world order being ruled by a scientific dictatorship through a scientific elite. And we have these today, these secret societies, if you want to call them that. Folks, the book Technocracy Rising has created quite a stir among people that pay attention to world events. Folks, you can go to Mr. Wood's website. And let me pull it up here. Technocracy.news. That's technocracy.news. Sign up for his newsletter. You can get his book also on Amazon in paperback and Kindle edition. The reviews are fantastic. Again, bookmark Patrick's site, technocracy.news. We talked about a number of things again, as I said, in the first half of the show, and we are going to get into covering some new ground in this segment and into the next hour. We talked about the transforming of the economy. We talked about how technocracy is the science of social engineering, the system of scientific dictatorship, and no spender left behind. I really like that phrase, no spender left behind. Reminds me of the passage in the Bible about the mark of the beast. Anyway, back to Patrick. Patrick, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. Let's get into some of the areas that we have not talked about. In your book, you have it laid out in a way that is, in my opinion, very helpful, because you put it together. It's just very succinct. And we've covered so far, you know, the history and what is technocracy, the Trilateral Commission and the history before that, the transforming economics. Let's get into how technocracy can transform government, religion, even law.
Wow. Those are difficult, difficult topics for people to get their head around, but let's try it.
Okay. We have one of the smartest audiences in the world, so So don't be afraid.
If my theory is correct, and I say that rhetorically, I fully believe that it is correct at this point. But if it's correct, and we should see this transformation process taking place across the whole spectrum of society, purposely so, not just kind of happenstance, but happening on purpose. We see, for instance, with, let's say, transforming government. Well, it's interesting that back in right after the Rio de Janeiro conference that produced what we saw with Agenda 21, we saw that that Bill Clinton started. Well, let's see. 1992 was the Earth Summit that produced the book. Let me just get my timeline straight here. In March of 93, Clinton and Gore, president and vice president, both members of the Trilateral Commission, by the way, they announced a national partnership for reinventing government. An interesting, I mean, nobody really paid attention. I remember that very day. I had no idea about technocracy even then. I thought, wow, it's reinventing government. Dang. Probably needs to be reinvented, you know, like maybe you serve the people for a change. Well, that wasn't it. That wasn't it at all. A month later, the Agenda 21 book was published. 2 months after that, Clinton signed an executive order called the President's Council on Sustainable Development. He didn't waste any time. Even though it wasn't law in our country, he said, we're doing this, guys. Didn't matter. We're going to do it by executive order. 3 months after that, Clinton signed another executive order called the National Performance Review, Reinventing Government. And the rest is history. This transformed the executive branch of our government, which is, that's what we look at when we say the government. It's basically the executive branch, all of the agencies and how they interact with people and stuff like that. That's the government supposed to serve the people. Well, thanks to Bill Clinton and Al Gore, the government was reinvented for the sake of implementing sustainable development. It completely opposite of what the founders of our country intended the government would be. And nobody challenged it back then. They later called anybody who even mentioned the word Agenda 21 a nut, you know, a part of that vast right-wing conspiracy. You know, that's a myth. Who ever heard of that?
In 2009, the Department of Homeland Security released a lexicon listing several different belief systems and ideologies as possible domestic terrorist or extremism, in which one of them was Agenda 21, another one was a Christian identity, another one was the Patriot Movement, anti-global warming, and etc. And they do this. This is how they, you know, to scare people into submission and label those who oppose their agenda.
So government was indeed reinvented, and you know, today people look at the government, most people have absolutely no clue about this transforming process that took place. But what they do know, what they see on the surface of it, they understand that there's something wrong with the executive branch because the Congress has absolutely no control over it. Absolutely no control. It's like the Congress has been neutered.
The executive branch has allowed each individual agency department head to change the law through the Federal Register without any congressional approval, which is how they've made 40-some thousand changes alone to the Obamacare bill and how they set new policy without having a vote.
Exactly. So, you know, this is one of the byproducts of the reinvention of government. They have completely isolated Congress to where Congress is thoroughly irrelevant. And I hate to say that. I mean, I'm not bashing Congress. Don't get me wrong. I love the Republican form of government that we're supposed to have. But that's not what we have today. And you know, we have sent some good people to Washington over the last 30 years. I'm you almost want to cry over the whole thing, but we sent some good men and women to Washington occasionally. And they get there, and after they're there about 2 months, it's like, where did they go? What happened to old Bill? What happened to old Mary? And all of a sudden, they've been completely consumed by the system, and they're marching around like good little robots, like the rest of, you know, the people around them, completely ineffective at doing what they said they're going to do when they got to Washington, D.C. And these were good people. I am convinced they were good people before they got there. But something happens when you go to Washington. I don't know what it is. You go there and you spend too much time, man. It's like the Borg, you know, on Star Trek. Remember? The Borg. Yeah. We will assimilate. We will assimilate. And, yeah. You know, it's like you get around these people and all of a sudden you find yourself changing.
And well, they have extortion, you know, bribery, and a number of ways to make people comply with their agenda, to wholesale, just making something up to ruin a person's name and reputation if they don't play ball.
I know. They have ways to beat you down and beat you up. So at this point, you know, I've been convinced for some time we're not going to change anything. I don't care who we send to Congress. It's not going to change. You can work as hard as you want, send anybody you want, but they're not going to be, it doesn't matter if you're a congressman or senator, you will not change anything. At this point in time, you will not change anything. That's sad. I could almost say the same thing about our national election as well. Because, even if Trump gets elected, and I expect that he will, quite honestly, just the way I look at the political spectrum, I think he's going to get elected. But Trump's going to get in there, and he's going to have his first cabinet meeting. You can just see how this is going to play out, where all the different secretaries of these agencies come to the table. And even if he appoints brand new ones all the way across the board, you know, they're going to come to the table, and they're going to say, this is how things work around here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's... Now, unless he's willing just to shut down some of those agencies, which is what Ron Paul wanted to do, by the way, and I think probably that could happen just fine. Just shut them down. Tell them all go home. You're fired. Wouldn't that be great? How about just sending HUD home? Oh, man, I just can't imagine. How about just dismantling the whole Obamacare nightmare?
Yeah.
You know, but that's not going to happen. That's a nice dream.
It is a nice dream. You make a good point because, you know, people are looking to the presidential, whoever gets elected, well, specifically Trump, as their political savior. And we know there's no political solution to a spiritual problem. And this is like having a new pastor at your church. And because you have a new pastor at your church, that all of a sudden, all the sin in your life is going to be cleaned up and taken care of. When in reality, it needs to start at, you know, the individual level, and each and every one of us needs to do our part, and then to the local level, state level, and federal level for changes. But in fact, people look at it in the backwards direction, looking for, you know, the president to save all the woes of society, and that's just not realistic in any society.
Exactly. So we talked a little bit about government. Let's look at the religious side. Yeah, the religious side, of course. It's interesting that the religions of the world have climbed on board with sustainable development, climate change stuff, green economy. When I say they've climbed on board, I mean they have climbed on board. The Catholic, let's just start with the Pope. The Pope wrote an encyclical last summer on climate change. He took his encyclical and presented it to a joint session of the United Nations last fall. And the Catholic Church is sold out, lock, stock, and barrel, to what I call green religion. And all the rest of them have, too. And not just Christian, not just the Christian side of things, but everybody. You know, Islam, Buddhism, Shintoism, Hinduism, the whole gamut of world religions are bought into this. And in 2014, there was a big interfaith summit on climate change. Interfaith is that buzzword. It means all the different churches of the world and all the other religions of the world came. Everybody was represented. The World Council of Churches issued a press release after that conference was done. And here's what the World Council of Churches said. Direct quote from their press release. There has never been such a large amount of religious environmental activity in one location in the history of the world. This week will mark a watershed in the history of religion. It will be the time that people remember as the time when the world's faiths declared themselves irrevocably as green faiths. Close quote. Yikes. Whoa.
Yeah, wow.
See, okay, well, isn't that interesting? All the religions of the world have declared themselves irrevocably as green faiths. And we see this trickling down even into the evangelical church today as well. You know, where people are all concerned about this stuff, and things like social justice now has trickled down on the backs of all this, because the United Nations is big on this, the whole concept of social justice. You hear it everywhere, in every one of their websites. Social justice this, social justice that, and it travels on the back of you know, green stuff, sustainable development stuff like that. Just incredible. So, yep, the world's religions have sold out to this whole thing. They're supporting the structure at this point. And it's even slipped down into the evangelical churches, many of them, as I said, as well. So that's a transformation that's taken place. And, well, okay, you can't do much about that. It's just the way it is. If your church is involved in any of this green stuff, you have two choices. You either go slap the pastor hard across the right cheek. Oh, just kidding. You either go slap your pastor and say, "What are you doing? Don't do this. This is wrong. No, no, no." And show them why it's wrong. Or you put your tennis shoes on and you run like crazy. I don't know. Your choice, I suppose. You can either stay and try and confront them or run. You probably won't do anything to change them. But maybe you feel a duty and a responsibility to tell them and confront them, because maybe you've been at that church for 20 years or 30 years, you know, and that's your family. And all of a sudden, they changed. You didn't change, they changed.
Yeah, and you did an interview with Sheila Zielinski. She's a friend of the show, and she wrote a book, The Green Gospel, where she gets into this a lot. And the World Council of Churches and this interfaith movement is something that is so appalling to me as a Christian. And it's not only the interfaith movement, it is the churches, especially the Christian churches in general. Before the Supreme Court gave their opinion on gay marriage or homosexual marriage, I had to leave the Presbyterian Church because they voted as a church organization to adopt homosexual marriage before it was even considered law or fiat law in this country. And so many churches have done the same. And they're also adopting this interfaith movement where they are combining Judaism, Islam, and Christianity into one religion.
Yep.
And they expect people to accept this.
Yep. So let's talk about reflexive law. You brought that up too. Great topic. This blew my mind. By the way, this whole topic of reflexive law. You've read my chapter. What chapter number is that, reflexive law? Yeah, I forget offhand. It's,
I think it is a number...
Yeah, chapter 7. Chapter 7, Transforming Law. You read my chapter. You understand my personal journey to understand reflexive law. It was just... using the word miraculous would be kind of cheap, but how I discovered reflexive law was just amazing, because I am not a lawyer. I wanted to be a lawyer when I was growing up, but I'm not a lawyer. But reflexive law was an alternative legal system, legal theory, that was developed back in the mid-1980s by a German scholar. And it spread like wildfire because it was a legal system that would be used to support sustainable development with, you know, that's the economic system, technocracy, whatever. The old rule of law would never, ever, ever work for technocracy. There's all kinds of reasons why it wouldn't work, but it would not work. So the scholars came up with a new economic theory, and they called it reflexive law. And it's twisted. I'm not even going to try to tell you exactly what it is. It's twisted.
This is something I read this chapter two or three times, and I have a very light grasp of it. Okay. But it is.
Do you agree?
Important.
It's twisted.
Oh yeah, yeah. Very well, much so.
I know. Here's one statement from one of these scholars that just tells you what reflexive law is all about. This is a very interesting quote. This guy wrote, "At the same time, sustainable development's broad sweep strains our intellectual grasp." This is my emphasis, okay? I can't help it. I'm not trying to imitate anybody, but you just got to say it this way, right? "At the same time, sustainable development's broad sweep strains our intellectual grasp of its meaning and outruns the capacity of our current legal and political systems to channel society's activities towards its achievement." Just pause for a second. What balderdash, what audacity this guy would have to say something like this. "It outruns the capacity of our current legal and political systems." Okay, out with the old, in with the new, okay? Then he goes on, quote, "There is no doubt that sustainable development needs new paradigms to transform it from visionary rhetoric to a viable political goal." Close quote. Did you catch that? Even the experts, what were they calling sustainable development? Visionary rhetoric.
Yeah.
You see, back in the day, 1973 to 1983, all of this stuff about sustainable development was just visionary rhetoric. Now, can I translate that? Crude or rude. It's BS. That's all. It's just BS. Visionary rhetoric. It's nothing. It's talk. It's just a pipe dream in the sky. But they had to transform it. If they wanted to get there, they had to transform it into a viable political goal. Now, that required other things like propaganda, the United Nations, sustainable development, global warming, punishing the deniers, and all this other stuff. That's all in view here. But reflexive law was this new paradigm to transform it from visionary rhetoric to a viable political goal. Now, I came out of a farming community in California, and I've watched my farmer friends and some family and stuff like that get beat up by the eco movement because they get sued all the time over, you know, some stupid little, you know, two-toed snail darter or something is off in a corner of their property. "Oh, you can't plow over there. You might hurt the little two-toed snail darter. He'd been almost extinct for 1,000 years. It's like, okay, how can you get taken to court and whooped like a dog and lose pitifully and be punished and fined and in some cases arrested and put in jail over a two-toed snail darter or whatever the heck it was out on a corner of your property that you've been farming, you and your family, for 100 years successfully. Well, I'll tell you how they lost every single case in court, because the lawyers for the environmental lawsuits brought reflexive law along with them and applied it to their cases in court, and even the judges did not see the sleight of hand. They never saw it. Maybe some of them were participating with it, but most of them never saw it in the early days. They got schnuckered. And once they started losing cases, the farmers just continued to lose cases, and the environmentalists just continued to win cases, and they've won virtually every stinking case for the last 40 years because of reflexive law. It was a new paradigm to transform sustainable development from visionary rhetoric to a viable political goal. I guess I get worked up about that, don't I?
Well, no, it is incredible, and it's interesting. And reading from in your book here, in the chapter we're talking about, seven, transforming law, you write the following. You say that as rules are developed and added to other rules, what appeared chaotic is now supposed to have order and harmony. However, the thought of order from chaos is no better than Darwin's unproven theory that species evolve from less complex to more complex. The legal world today experiences more chaos than ever before. The problem with reflective law is that it cannot operate in a vacuum, as is suggested, but is at all times subject to those who control it. It is ripe for manipulation. Reflective law practitioners can thus direct discourse, the outcome, the rulemaking, in a very real sense, like the Old West vigilante concept of the local self-appointed sheriff being judge, jury, and executioner. And that's so very well said, Mr. Wood. As we are coming up against our top of the hour break, folks, you're listening to Patrick Wood, the author of Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. I urge each and every one of you to visit his website and get a copy of this book. It's so crucial. You can go to technocracynew.news. That's technocracy.news. His books are available on Amazon in paperback and on Kindle. Folks, go to Amazon and search Technocracy Rising. It's an honor and a pleasure to have Mr. Wood on with us. This is his first time on the Hagman and Hagman Report, and we went through 2 hours of content already. When we come back, we're going to talk about a few more issues, from the total surveillance society to transforming humanity, and the final clamps of the new world order in our society, from transforming Christianity to the Earth's charter, and what actions we can take in this war against transhumanism, technology, and God-created human race. We'll be right back.